From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week review the thriller John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum. It pairs Keanu Reeves and Halle Berry. The teenage romantic drama The Son is also a star in wide release this week. And the action-adventure comedy A Dog's Journey, starring Dennis Quaid and Josh Gad, also out this week. We'll talk with the film's director, Gail Mancuso, on Film Week. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us. A lot of movies to talk about this week, as well as director Gail Mancuso. She has a feature film out this week that we're going to talk about, A Dog's Journey, but a noted television director from Roseanne, and you name it, Friends, the list goes on forever of all the episodic TV she's directed. We'll talk about that shift, as well as Women in the Director's Chair. That comes up later on Film Week. We are joined this week by critics Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian, and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom, and Wade Major, film critic for Synagogues.com. We begin with the action film John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum. Keanu Reeves stars as the retired but still deadly hitman Chad Stahelski. Chad Stahelski is the director, and Lawrence Fishburne, Ian McShane, and Halle Berry co-star.
I'm not service anymore, John, so I don't go around shooting people in the head.
I'm not asking you to kill anyone. I just need you to get me to him.
To who?
Your old boss.
You want to kill Baratta?
I'm not going to kill him. I just need to talk.
What could he possibly give to you?
Guidance.
A lot of whispering.
What
did you think, Wade, of John Wick?
She doesn't go around shooting people in the head until about 5 minutes later, when both of them are shooting a lot of people in the head. That's the only reason people go to see these movies, is to see a lot of people get shot in the head. They have the highest body count of, I think, any movies that I've seen in decades. So the John Wick films all basically scratch a particular cathartic itch, which is to watch this Clockwork Orange-style ultra-violence so that we don't carry it out in our own lives. And they go above and beyond. They go to a ridiculous extreme. The body count is just astronomical. It's on a John Woo level, from his Hong Kong films. And each one of these movies has sort of upped the ante since. Each one is about a little bit longer. This one's over 2 hours now. The last one was right at 2 hours. And now it seems like everyone in New York and pretty much everyone in Morocco, where this detours to momentarily, is an assassin. They're all out after John Wick. The bounty on his head is even higher now. And the mythology is even more elaborate. You know, we've had this mythology of the International Assassins Organization and the rules they follow and the hotels that they're not allowed to kill each other in. And now it gets even more elaborate. There's this high table, and Aja Kate Dillon plays the adjudicator who comes and casts judgment on John Wick. And before long, it's impossible to really keep track of all the rules that they have. But you don't really care. It doesn't make sense that he goes to Morocco to see Halle Berry and something happens in the desert. None of that makes sense. But you don't care because the action scenes are so elaborate, so well choreographed, so much fun. I laughed like I've never laughed before. It was a lot of fun, and I don't care that it makes no sense.
Four accredited screenwriters to try and make it make sense.
Yes.
I like making sense of this. I might be one of the only John Wick fans who actually enjoys all the talking scenes as much as all of the killing. But I like this strange deadpan society that he lives in. Angelica Houston shows up in here. Everybody's sort of threatening. They never smile. They're very serious. And there's this huge weight of ceremony and obligation and forcible tattoos to show that you did this thing. I mean,
even among the ladies who work the switchboards and everyone has those tattoos.
I enjoy all of it. I mean,
that's a great name for a rock group, right? Forcible tattoo.
Forcible tattoo. If you come to our show, I mean, the killing here is, of course, like the highlight for most people in the audience. And they do, I find, a good job in making them interesting. I get really zoned out at like the end of the Avengers when a million people get mowed down with guns. I'm like, whatever, I don't care. But here, it's very smart. The first fight is with books. There's a knife fight that's spectacular.
That knife fight is through the roof.
It's amazing.
That is amazing.
A fight with horses that I was like, okay, we're getting a little into like Arnold Schwarzenegger on a horse riding through a mall territory. But they rescue it. There's several dogs. You heard one of them breathing in the back of that clip. I mean, I enjoyed so much of the choreography in here. There's a motorcycle fight scene that I don't understand how they shot. And, like, my boyfriend is a director, and as we left, he was like, I don't understand how they shot that. It's really outstanding work that they're putting together
here. It is what John Woo was doing in the early 1990s with The Killer and A Better Tomorrow and all of those films, where you know that it's outrageous and outlandish and that it's preposterous, but the choreography of it, the execution of it is so operatic. So there's a carnival-like glee to just working out in your head, how did they put that together, especially the knife fight. That knife fight, which occurs fairly early on, is rhythmic. It's almost like a song, and it's like a ballet. There's something amazing about every single one of these, and they keep getting more and more outrageous.
This reminds me of the best of the martial arts films.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of that. Starting in John Wick 2, they brought in a lot of Hong Kong talent and a lot of Chinese talent to give it that quality.
If there's people who are Raid fans out there, you'll enjoy a nice cameo.
Thoroughly,
at the end.
Yes. Mark Dacascos, who's getting on in years, doesn't do a lot of action films anymore, but he plays the main nemesis here, and he does it beautifully. It is very tongue in cheek. Also worth noting too, these are all in a chronological continuity. Every John Wick film picks up exactly where the previous one left off. There's no sort of a day later, a year later. They are all three of these films are a straight through line.
Does it stand on its own, though? I mean, if you haven't seen the previous, are you okay watching this?
I'm not sure. I mean, if you've never seen any of the other ones, it might be interesting to watch a film that starts off with the hero already battered and bruised, and you're like, how is he going to survive the next 2 hours?
There is a lot of reference to – they always reference that this all started because of a dog and because of a stolen car. So it does help to have at least seen the first one so that you know how ridiculous it is that they keep upping the ante and upping the ante. They do seem to be making up the mythology as it goes along a little bit, but I kind of don't care. Also, quick note, Lance Reddick, who has been the concierge in the previous two films, finally gets a gun.
All right.
They finally give him a gun.
Chad Stahelski, who directed it, did the previous John Wick films. He's a stunt guy also, I understand.
Yeah, I think that's really what gives these movies like the oomph and the real life sweat.
John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum, starring Keanu Reeves and Halle Berry. It's rated R in wide release. The Sun is also a star, romantic teen drama, directed by Rai Russo-Young, and written by Tracy Oliver. The film stars Yara Shahidi as a pragmatic teenager who believes in science and facts, but not love. Everything changes when she meets Daniel, and the two fall in love.
What are the five key ingredients to falling in love?
Fine. Mutual self-interest and socioeconomic compatibility.
Well, my ingredients are friendship and chemistry. Mm,
of course they are.
My last three are some sort of moral compass. Common interests are a must. And let's see, the X factor.
What's the X factor?
Don't worry, we've got it.
The film is The Sun is Also a Star, based on the book by Nicola Yoon. Amy?
You know what? I liked this movie a lot, Larry. This movie, I mean, it's about this young couple. They meet on a really pivotal day. Yara Shahidi plays a girl whose family is poised to be deported the next day back to Jamaica. Her father moved her here when she was a child. And so she's running around this whole day in New York trying to meet with her lawyer, meet with different lawyers, go to different agencies, see if anybody can help her out. She runs into him on the day that he's supposed to have his interview to get into medical school, which is really important to his parents. He's a first-generation Korean-American. And so they have this like kind of time pressure backdrop on this day of running together, but also a lot of forced time to have to hang out. And this movie is such kind of – it's very much like saying – A Before Sunrise set in New York. This movie loves New York. They have just this way of looking at all the people around them, taking in Harlem, Chinatown, Greenwich, all these neighborhoods that this couple bounces to on this like epic day. And there's just so much affection for what America is and what it should be. And these two kids as part of America, it just really won me over for a movie that is, granted, maybe like a third of the running time is just staring at these two beautiful teenagers. I mean, Yara Shahidi, she's a really strong screen presence. She comes from like Grown-ish and Black-ish. Melton is in Riverdale. And the camera just watches them, bathes them in neon light, has them kiss in real close-up all the time. The music's dreamy. It just works. It just does.
I could see it, Amy. You're entranced by the movie. That's great.
I seem to say this every week, but I cried at this one too, and Amy always makes fun of me for that. No, I did. It's a beautiful, beautiful film, and Yara Shahidi is a revelation. She's going to be an enormous star. This pushes a lot of the same buttons as all of the movies that sort of follow a similar pattern. We could call it the Before trilogy, Before Sunrise, the Linklater films with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. A Man and a Woman, you know, the French film from way back. It has all of those same poetic qualities. And the thing that you may not even realize, because it's so much about New York and America and the melting pot, apart from a guy, an extra on a subway with a throwaway line, there are no Caucasian-speaking parts in this film. And you don't even notice it until the end. And there's
I didn't even notice that. Wow.
I know. And there's something kind of remarkable about that. It's very much in her family, in his family, and then a few other peripheral characters. But it's very intimate. It's wonderful. Their chemistry is extraordinary. And I think the chemistry is what really drives the film more than anything else. You just want to see them together all the time in every frame.
The Sun is also a star, teen romantic drama starring Yara Shahidi and Charles Melton, Rye Russo Young. The director, Tracy Oliver, adapted Nicola Yoon's book. It's rated PG-13 in wide release. A Dog's Journey, also a wide release this week. It's a family adventure comedy directed by veteran of television comedy, Gail Mancuso. It's her feature film directing debut. The movie's a follow-up to the 2017 A Dog's Purpose. The film is co-written by Maya Forbes, Catherine Michon, and Wallace Wolodarski.
Today was a good day.
Well, I finally got a call from the cruise line.
Gloria spent a lot of time talking to her hand.
And they needed a singer for their stagecoach lounge. I know.
There's nothing in that cup.
Oh, did you make me a cup?
Mama.
Thank you. Well, it's perfect for me, right?
Delicious.
That delicious?
Wait, there was something in that cup?
The film is A Dog's Journey, rated PG. Amy?
Yeah, that clip is a dog not understanding what fake tea time is to a toddler and being incredibly confused. A Dog's Journey is in the same universe as A Dog's Purpose. That was the movie where the dog died and died and died and died again and came back as different dogs in order to learn that its true purpose was to love Dennis Quaid, its original owner. And Dennis Quaid is here. The dog is now an older dog. They're both old people living on this farm. And Dennis Quaid has a granddaughter who's... father has died before she was really born, and that's Dennis Quaid's son-in-law. And so this whole movie is Dennis Quaid sort of bequeathing the old dog when it passes on to the old world, because Dennis Quaid has realized that this dog keeps being reincarnated for a purpose to protect CJ, the granddaughter, when she's taken away by her mom, Gail, who's a cruise ship singer, wannabe singer, kind of bitter. Here, put in this film as basically being like the worst mom of all time in a way that's borderline really cringeworthy as you're watching it. So the dog is now reincarnated to protect CJ as she grows up, as she goes through high school, as she has terrible boyfriends, as she moves to New York to become a singer, has more terrible boyfriends, and then finally falls in love and is happy. And the dog's really annoying. I have to say that up front. I mean, you could hear a little bit of the dog narration there. The dog has a way of, you know, being there as comic relief when, say, like, people are talking about cancer. And the dog is over there in the corner being like, I wish this bed was made out of bacon. And you're thinking, dog, we don't really need to hear from you at this moment. And yet I cried. I think it's been that kind of week, too. I don't know what's happening. You kind of can't get around crying when you see dogs die or people hugging dogs and the people dying as the people are hugging a dog. Even though this is a movie that has a literal rainbow bridge that the dog runs over. I mean... I don't know what to say about a movie like this, to be honest. I mean, there's so many of these dog movies lately. Just in January, I think I might have been on here talking about A Dog's Way Home. That was another movie about a dog trying to find its owner, narrated by another very annoying dog. What if dogs aren't really this annoying when we get to hear inside their head? What if they're actually very smart and lovely?
Well, it's all relative, right? Dog's Journey is the adventure comedy starring Dennis Quaid, Josh Gad, Gail Mancuso, the director, and it's written by W. Bruce Cameron, Catherine Michon, Maya Forbes, and Wally Wolodarski. It's rated PG. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics have to say about the Swedish sci-fi film Aniara, also The Souvenir, which stars Honor Swinton Byrne,
and Tilda Swinton, I believe mother and daughter, right, starring
That's
in this
right.
film?
Yep.
So we'll hear about that and the biographical doc, The Serengeti Rules. Those and more movies coming up with our critics. Do want to remind you our next Film Week screening, Saturday night, July 27th at the beautiful historic theater at Ace Hotel, downtown on Broadway. It's Boogie Nights, Paul Thomas Anderson's film, 7 p.m. The screening followed by post-film conversation. We're going to have a lot of fun talking about that movie, which follows the adult film industry as it becomes the home video industry. Great ensemble cast, so many terrific actors, and P.T. Anderson's screenplay. Tickets, kpecc.org/in-person. Back in a minute. Very appropriately, the University of Pittsburgh is getting the archives of the late horror filmmaker George Romero. Given the fact he loved filming in Pittsburgh, makes sense that Pitt would end up with his archives. The university announcing the acquisition this week. Scholars, students, filmmakers will be able to see the original annotated Night of the Living Dead script, a foam latex zombie head, and so much more. Sounds like quite the horror film tourist attraction at the University of Pittsburgh. We continue with our Film Week critics, Wade Major and Amy Nicholson. Next up, the Swedish sci-fi drama Aniara. The film is written and directed by Pella Kugerman and Hugo Lilja. Amy, what'd you think of Aniara?
This is a low-budget sci-fi film that I cannot recommend highly enough for people who want to see something ambitious, epic, emotional, gigantic, smart, depressing, and a little nihilistic on what looks like a fairly low-budget format. What this film is about is it starts off with just a quick montage showing the destruction of the Earth with global warming, getting through that very fast to get to just like some sort of average people, middle-class folks, taking this transport ship to go and live on the moon. And you can see when the camera kind of glances around the faces that something awful has happened. A lot of people are scarred. A lot of people are brutal. But the ship itself is sort of like a mall. You know, it's kind of a cruise ship taking people on what's supposed to be a three-week journey that ends up becoming much, 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 much longer. And really kind of the driving character of this is a woman who operates this kind of station on the ship called Mima. And what Mima is it's where you can go in and lie on the ground and sort of meditate for a bit and sort of picture your life past on the Earth. And Mima helps get inside your brain and give you this image of the things that you miss. And that's what you think the film is going to start being about. But then it really just becomes about the society around it and this woman who running Mima becoming sort of a notorious figure on the ship in a way where you see her popularity rise and fall and rise and fall. I mean, this film just feels sort of like this epic, epic tale, the kind of thing you would see a James Michener novel about, taking place on this ship. And it's just really stunningly well done.
We're talking about the Swedish sci-fi drama Aniara. Wade?
I'm a little less enthusiastic, but guardedly. So this is based on a 1956 epic poem by Swedish Nobel laureate Harry Martinson, which is a poem I've never read, but it was also turned into an opera a few years later, and it's very popular in Sweden, and it's inspired generations to you know, with its ethical questions. And the idea in the poem is there's a ship, just exactly as Amy describes, taking people to Mars, and it winds up getting knocked off course, and before you know it, a three-week trip to Mars turns into decades in space, and these people have to now question what is the meaning of life, and is there purpose to our lives anymore if we have no destination, if we're going to just be trapped here in space forever. And that's a
must
really...
must be 3 weeks to the moon. You
yeah.
said Mars, right?
It's Mars. No, it's
oh,
Mars.
Oh, it is Mars.
Yeah, it's Mars. Three weeks to Mars. Well,
not
that's...
bad.
It's a fast ship. It's a very interesting premise, and it raises all kinds of fascinating existential questions. And the way they handle it in the film is very interesting. You know, when you skip from year one to year two to year three, and it is episodic, but yet it is not episodic at the same time. The problem is that once you move from epic poem to movie, now you have to sort of harden some of your scientific considerations. And I sat there thinking, okay, why didn't they have a backup system? why aren't there other ships that could come and rescue them? You start kind of going through all the logistical problems inherent in the scenario.
Is this what you asked yourself when you saw Titanic?
I did. Absolutely. Absolutely. But there are scientific reasons for that, and that's a document of history. So once I was able to get past some of that, then I was able to sort of absorb some of the bigger existential questions. And on that level, it's aspiring to be a little bit like a Tarkovsky film, like Solaris. It's going in some of those...
That's what I was thinking as Amy was describing it.
And you know, again, Tarkovsky, Russian director, but worked in Sweden. There's a, when you live in Northern Europe and it's cold, you spend a lot of time wondering about life. And so it does have that quality to it. But I had to hurdle a lot of scientific considerations, a lot of logistical issues in order to get there.
Aniara, the Swedish sci-fi drama, is rated R at the New Art Theater in West L.A. The mystery romance The Souvenir stars Honor Swinton Byrne, Tom Burke, and Tilda Swinton, written and directed by Joanna Hogg. Wade?
So Joanna Hogg is a top-tier, really first-rate independent filmmaker in the U.K. This is a very, very well-crafted film that follows a somewhat well-worn premise. And the premise, Honor Swinton Byrne, who is Tilda Swinton's daughter and is making her major, her starring role here. She was in I Am Love as a young girl about 10 years ago, but with her mom again. But here she carries the movie, and Tilda is in a supporting part as her mother. And she's a young film student who is making a documentary about dock workers and meets a man who works for the British government, and they wind up having a troublesome affair. And in terms of movies that tell you about people who get into relationships that turn out badly and go south very quickly, this doesn't really pioneer any new ground. You're watching this because the performances are so good and because Hogg has a really interesting visual style, the way that she composes her actors in the frame, the way she directs them, is very, very compelling. I would say even though the movie is generally kind of unremarkable in where it goes to a very familiar place. Honor Swinton Byrne, that's an apple that fell right next to the tree. She is astonishing. She is a power talent in her own right, and we're going to see really big things
from
her.
So this isn't just nepotism. This is
talent. Oh, no. This is real talent. And, you know, her father is a Scottish playwright, so there's a lot of talent there as well.
Yeah, a lot of genetic powerhouse there. Amy, what did you think of The Souvenir?
Yeah, I mean, this is a film that people just worshipped coming out of this year's Sundance. It's the sort of film I feel like I'm always trying to like a little bit more than I do because it is just so handsome. It's so wonderfully done. You can tell you're in the hands of like a filmmaker who knows exactly what she wants this film to be. You know, it's very reserved. It's very beautiful. I think to me the standout here is Tom Burke, who plays the bad boyfriend. He has this face that you cannot decide if you want to rescue him or push him off a cliff. Like, he's so perfect in that. And this movie is set in the early 80s, so he shows up in these ridiculous like posh outfits. I mean... It's an impressive film. It's an impressive film. I think for me, it's a little hard to love, but I'm glad to see it.
I agree.
And our Justin Chang apparently just loved this
film. I think almost anybody else you would have had on the show would have loved it maybe more than the two of us.
Right. So we'll keep that in mind. The film is The Souvenir. Joanna Hogg, the writer-director, it's rated R at the Landmark West LA and the Arclight in Hollywood. The biographical documentary The Serengeti Rules is directed by Nicholas Brown. It's his feature directorial debut. Wade?
What an amazing documentary this is. Really extraordinary. It takes its title from the book of the same name by Sean Carroll that was published about 3 years ago. But the central figure here is Bob Payne, who is a zoologist who died the same year that the book was published in 2016. This movie wouldn't exist if not for Bob Payne. Nicholas Brown actually was able to track him down on the eve of his death and interview him basically in his deathbed for several hours. And that interview... intercut with other interviews with other scientists who are all inspired by him and his work is what forms the backbone of this film. And the photography is extraordinary. And what it is, this is basically a nature documentary about the fate of the Earth, about biodiversity, and how human beings have inadvertently changed the ecological balance of the planet. And the chain reaction that you get by changing one small thing, if you attack something at the bottom or at the top of the food chain, how does that impact not just the rest of the food chain, but every other part of the ecology that relies on the food chain being what it is? And what they find is both depressing and incredibly encouraging, which is that we have impacted things in ways we never imagined. But at the same time, nature is resilient and finds a way back and has shown us the way to repair it and to enable it to repair itself. It's a miraculous documentary. It's really extraordinary.
The Serengeti Rules at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. It's unrated. The British horror comedy Slaughterhouse Rules with a Z is directed by Crispian Mills, and it stars Asa Butterfield, Simon Pegg, and Nick Frost. Amy.
Yeah, this is the sort of film that if it had come out in the late 90s, it would have been a massive cult hit. And now I fear it's sort of like in this modern world of film, it's going to come and go very, very fast. But what it is it's a very, very fun movie, kind of dumb, kind of goofy, set in a British boarding school with Simon Pegg as one of the professors, Nick Frost as an ex-student living out in the woods, and a cast of sort of young people, Asa Butterfield is one of them, who go to this school, which I would describe as sort of a punk rock Harry Potter. You know, there's people classified into different groups. There's the snobs and the losers and the jerks. And this being Britain, and if anybody ever follows like any of the sex dramas coming out of the British boarding school, like the one that kind of implicated the Prime Minister David Cameron a few years back, there's a lot of sex in here, a lot of like curious initiation rites. And meanwhile, as all this tension is going, all these teenagers are figuring out who loves who and what do we do. There's mysteries about the boy who killed himself last year and what's really going on with these people who are fracking in the woods outside the school. And why does the headmaster, Michael Sheen, feel okay with that? And why are people dying? And it builds in a very comic way. There's giant fights and explosions and things. I mean, if I was in high school, I would have been super happy to discover this film on the video store library. You know, as it is now, I'm sort of like, you tried, it's great. And it almost just makes me sad I don't live in that world of the 90s anymore, where I would just worship this film.
And Margot Robbie makes an appearance here.
Very, very briefly. She plays a girlfriend who's long distance, and she shows up over Skype. I almost wonder if she had to even,
that's
like,
pretty funny.
If she could just Skype in from whatever else she's
Skype
doing right now.
Skype cameo in a film. Slaughterhouse Rules with a Z is at the AMC Atlantic Times Square in Monterey Park. It's rated R. Trial by Fire, a biographical drama telling the story of Cameron Todd Willingham, executed in Florida for killing his three children. Ed Zwick, the director, Laura Dern, Jack O'Connell, and Emily Mead star. Wade?
This is kind of a classic miscarriage of justice film. It follows a fairly well-worn template that we've seen in movies like Dead Man Walking and Murder in the First, and even to some marginal degree things like The Verdict and To Kill a Mockingbird. It's essentially about this guy. He's put on trial for a crime where there's tons of evidence, and he presumably didn't do it. And a faithful attorney steps in and tries to work the system. And the only thing that kind of sets it apart is that Ed Zwick, who, of course, we've known for a very long time, all the way back to Glory, a co-creator of 30-something.
Yeah, I was going to say, acclaimed TV before them.
Yeah, Ed Zwick is a really, really accomplished director. He knows how to close. And even though this is a very familiar subject and goes in kind of a predictable direction, he really, really works it. And you are immersed in these characters, and that's what sort of elevates it above what it would otherwise be.
What did you think, Amy?
I mean, I was really excited to see this because the case in question, Cameron Todd Willingham, has become fairly famous. There was a large New Yorker article about it a few years ago.
Which this is based on.
Yeah. The title is actually taken directly from the New York article. And what it is about is, he was convicted on bad science about arson that has since been disproven. And it was also the last days of the satanic panic. So the investigator said he poured gasoline on the fire in a pentagram. And what they were hoping to prove with Cameron Todd Willingham is that if they could prove, even after the fact of his execution, that he was executed unjustly, that he was an innocent man, they've been looking for a case to take all the way up to the Supreme Court, which still may or may never happen. Rick Perry has been shutting down. He was shutting down when he was in charge all further investigations of this crime or of what really happened. So that said, I was really excited to go watch this movie, but I thought it was just so kind of dryly, faithfully done, the sort of movie where every character walks in and says exactly what's on their mind. I feel this and I feel this, that it doesn't really come to life for me, but it's at its best when they get into the science and how the science was rigged. And it is at its best when it kind of gets into the idea of just Cameron himself. He's a guy who was kind of a drunk, a ne'er-do-well, a lowlife of the town, the kind of guy that you could sort of imagine having done this. And they it feels like the town convicted him just because they already didn't like him and wanted him to go away. And so when it gets into issues of class and convicting a man who wasn't a saint, I find it more interesting.
Trial by Fire, the film starring Laura Dern, Jack O'Connell, Emily Mead, a screenplay from Jeffrey Fletcher, based on a New Yorker article by David Gran. Trial by Fire, rated R. You can see it at Lemley's Playhouse Pasadena, the Landmark in West L.A., and Edwards West Park in Irvine. Coming up, we're going to talk with director Gail Mancuso about her feature directorial debut, but that after years as the highest of profile television comedy directors. Back after this. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope you have a great weekend going. Heard a little bit about movies that are worth your time. Now we turn our attention to the art of making movies. And someone who's had an extraordinary career in television, directing many, many episodes of television classics from Friends, 30 Rock, Scrubs, Roseanne. Quite the career in Hollywood as a television, primarily comedic director, but also doing episodic dramas. But she makes her feature directorial debut this week in a movie that we were just talking about, A Dog's Journey. We're going to talk with her about making that transition, also about being a real pioneer as a women's director in television. Gail Mancuso joins us, multi-time Emmy winner, multi-nominee for Emmy Awards, and our Film Week critic, Claudia Puig, joins us as well, president of the LA Film Critics Association, and just importantly, former roommate of Gail's. It's another claim to fame, right?
That's my bigger claim to fame, for sure.
Gail, let me start with you. The transition to doing feature film. I mean, here you're someone extremely well known in the television community, and now you're making a feature film. Was it in any way like you're sort of starting over again, the fact that it is somewhat different than doing episodic TV?
You know, first of all, hi, Larry, and thank you for having me. And hi, Claudia.
Hi.
I miss you. It really was very, very interesting because it was a seamless transition for me. Because having done so much television, the wonderful thing about TV is that you get to practice your craft almost like every day. So episodic TV, like I do mostly comedies, you know, you prep for like 3 to 5 days and then you shoot for 5 days. So every week I'm on the set articulating direction to actors, working through story points, building characters, finding jokes, setting up shots. So making that transition to features was just seamless because it was just, okay, I'm back on the set.
Well, I wonder about just sort of if there's a different psychological approach. Because, I mean, one of the things about radio is it just goes out into the ether. You make a mistake, you kind of move on. There's a show the next day.
Yeah.
And I think of television, maybe not that much because people are watching these episodes years into the future. Nonetheless, the pace of television, I think of it as sort of less able to be perfected versus a film where you've got budget limitations and others, but still you can go back, you can reshoot, I would think. Is that at all a little different of a psychological approach?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, look, I mean, it's history. You're making history with a feature, as well as with TV shows, too. But this is even more so. So I wanted to make sure that we were doing it absolutely right. And every, you know, in the editing room, I kept saying to my editor, Rob Komatsu, I'm like, okay, we're making history here. Big red letter day. Should we use the close-up or the wide shot? No. But it felt the whole process was very natural to me. And I think a lot of that has to do with I had wonderful support from Amblin and Universal and Halle Barrio and my producer Gavin Pallone, just amazing talented people that really gave great notes and were collaborators. And I think I don't know if that would be true on other films.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It just seemed to be a really good first fit.
And I wonder about the control issue, because in television you've got showrunners, mm-hmm. who, you know, they have their Bible, and you've got actors that, if the series has been on for a while, have considerable clout and say as well. So you come in as the director, is that much more limited than doing a feature where you've got final say?
Yeah, I mean that was like the best part of the of doing a feature is because it is a director's medium, and so everything from the script, helping develop the script with the writers, all the way through the shooting process, all the way through the editorial, it's, you know, I just had a massive
must
say.
Felt like, yeah. Wow, wish it was like this all the time.
Yeah, I loved it. I kind of like it was a.
Well, you walked into a property that it already existed, too,
yes.
In the sense that there was a this is a sequel to A Dog's Purpose. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I was wondering, my thought was, you know, your first film and you're doing what W.C. Fields said never to do, working with kids and dogs. How hard is, I mean, that must have been a challenge.
You know, that's a great question. Well, first of all, I want to say about the sequel aspect of it. I wanted to make sure that this movie, A Dog's Journey, stood on its own, that you didn't have to see A Dog's Purpose to understand what was happening in Dog's Journey. So hopefully that happened. But once you did see this movie, that you would go back and see A Dog's Purpose, because that's a great movie also, of course.
But the working with animals and with kids, that's got to be a challenge.
Yes. Actually, I love working with kids, and really there was only one child, which was Emma Volk, who was 2 years old. I got to take a sip of water.
All right. Claudia, let me, while she does that, let's talk about women in television, because Gail, you know, with all these, you know, many, many episodes of television she had done, we've talked about in the film industry, it's only recently that we're starting to see critical mass of women directing feature films. And it's a long time coming.
I think films have been behind television in that regard. And it's really, that's a shame for films. But, you know, with the wealth, with the blurring of the lines between TV and film now and with streaming services and all of that, I think, you know, there's going to be more mixing and going back and forth, which I love. And you see something like Queen Sugar that Ava DuVernay created, and then she has all these women directors coming in. That's, you know, they work in that. It's episodic. Then they go and work in films. So I think we're seeing much more going back and forth. What do you think?
I totally agree with you, Claudia, as usual.
it's the roommate thing.
And I think it's a roommate thing. But there's so many platforms now which you can get your material on in terms of like Netflix, Amazon. There's, you know, so it's just a wonderful time to be a director. And you know, back when I started, there were three, maybe five broadcast channels back in the black and white days. No.
How many women were coming into the business at the time you started?
I could count on one hand. Now I can count on two. No, maybe three. But yeah, it was very, very limited, and also very little mentoring was done at that time. And now the tides have turned, and there's just a lot of programs out there, not only for women, but for diversity. And so we're seeing this is a great time for all you young filmmakers out there, or old filmmakers, anybody who has a message and wants to do their own film. Now's the time to do it.
Well, we joke that, you know, virtually anybody, it seemed, get a, you know, Amazon to, you know, or Netflix to put money out to make something. But that's got to be a way of giving a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't have had a chance to do so. The other thing is you can make an amateur film so inexpensively now that in a way that you couldn't before. You'd have to go to film school in the past to get a camera and, you know, film and be able to make a movie. Now kids growing up can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And how is that changing the business, Gail?
I think everything is for the better. I think it's great. I think, you know, people have their stories to tell and they're able to tell it, you know, however they use, you know, YouTube or whatever, they put their material up. And you could still use that as part of your reel. Hopefully you'll still go to school and learn the craft.
So you think more. Film school is important? Because some people, like Quentin Tarantino told me, said, no, we think, you know, there's no more point in going to film school since anybody make a movie. That's all you needed film school for in the past, he said, have access to the...
Well, I think what's great about film school is that you get to work with like-minded people, and you can, and as a community, you're building your community, and you're helping each other out, and I think that's really important. I think the other important thing is just to have life skills and being able to enjoy and travel and meet, you know, different people and be part of different cultures and all that. I did want to get back to your trial question really quick, if you don't mind.
I don't have time for it right now, but we'll have to come back to it later. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with Emmy-winning TV director Gail Mancuso, who this week, her feature directorial debut, A Dog's Journey, is out in wide release. She's directed such classic series as Friends, Scrubs, 30 Rock, Dharma and Greg, Modern Family, and many more. And our Film Week critic, Claudia Puig, also with us. Coming up, we're going to talk about women in film and television, and we welcome your calls, 866-893-KPCC, back in 1 minute. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking with our Film Week critic, president of the L.A. Film Critic Association, Claudia Puig, and we're talking with noted television director Gail Mancuso, who's made her feature film directorial debut in The Dog's Journey, starring Dennis Quaid, that's out this week in wide release. And we're talking about Gail's journey as someone who's one of just a few women directing in episodic television from the early days of Roseanne and Friends and all these classic sitcoms, all the way up through the rebooted Roseanne as well. Two-time Emmy Award winner, multi-time Emmy nominee. And we're talking about transition from television to film, as well as more women coming into both television directing and into feature film directing. If you want to talk about the increasing representation of women in film, we're at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Okay, now we have a chance, Gail, to talk about working
Claudia's,
with animals. Yeah,
Claudia's question from before, which is so great. I was going to say, the other actress, Emma Volk, who was 2 years old, she's obviously a child. But Abby Ryder Forston played 11-year-old CJ.
She was great.
How great was she?
Yeah, she was a really good little actress.
Her first scene, and this is why I say she's an old soul. Her first scene was the scene where she came and went toe-to-toe with Betty on the sidewalk there and told her mom off.
And, about keeping the dog
yes,
and saying you've been a bad mother and
yes,
all that. Wow.
How great was
that
she
was
in that?
That was a really good scene. Yeah.
And in terms of your animal question, it was great working with the animals because we had wonderful, wonderful dog trainer, Bonnie Judd. And
just one dog trainer for all those dogs?
She was the main one, and then she had her whole team to help with all the other dogs. But she trains through positivity and really good reward system. So after every scene, everybody would break out in cheers. Yay, you did that. So it was like one of the happiest sets I've ever been on in my life.
What about the monitoring of animals? I know that's a big deal now.
Yeah.
So you had someone on set
all
the time whose first job is to look after the animals?
Oh, someone's like we had a whole crew. So we, you know, being an animal lover myself, I have 5 dogs.
You were the perfect person to direct
Was I not the perfect
person to
direct it?
You had no break from dogs.
Well, the problem is that we shot out I was away from home, so I got my dog fix on a daily basis because I miss my animals.
Those dogs are so cute. All dog lovers should see this.
I know. So we had APA represented on the set, American Humane Society. We had the dogs had their own security room to go from set to the trailer. We wanted
to
make sure
they have their own personal assistants.
You know what? There was somebody giving them coffee. Yeah. And just but they were such
treats provided.
They were amazing, fun, and just happy, happy, happy dogs because they were in a happy environment.
As the first woman to win an Emmy for directing a comedy series, that was for Modern Family in 2013. You feel any sense of responsibility to women who are coming up in television as a result of having that honor? And how? What are the ways in which you try and respond to that?
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm part of many different organizations. I was part of the television. I was a governor on the Television Academy and we're part of that internship program. There's a lot of programs out there that young students can apply to that help, you know, mentor them through through shadowing and stuff. There's a great new program by NBC Female First that I'm on the board of, and they have a wonderful program where, you know, thousands and thousands of applicants, you know, applied and very few get in, but the ones that get in get to actually not only shadow on a certain show, but they are actually guaranteed an episode to direct. It's the first of its kind. Jennifer Salke originated that program.
Are these young people coming out of film school?
They're not. They're anybody. There's
really
commercial directors. There's just people that haven't done episodic or maybe just one episode, episodic television episode.
But in some way, they would be able to display, they have the ability to direct an episode, even if they've never done it.
Yes, because you have to have a reel.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also the Directors Guild of America, they have a great program, a dynamic and diverse program that I'm part of also.
I would think that a lot of this is about women being in executive management positions.
Yes.
Because not stereotype, but men necessarily notice the gender differences in representation. How much of a difference is made as more women are moving into these managerial positions?
Well, I think that's a great question because I think women will rise each other up. I mean, I think we need women who are in these managerial positions to help elevate new women coming into the business. And I think now that it seems like there is a more equal opportunity for women in managerial positions to do the hiring, I'm hoping to see more female directors coming up.
Claudia, as a film critic, what do you see as the difference in terms of not just women directors, but representation of women on screen? Do you feel as though that there's a broader array of women's lives that are depicted? And has that changed?
Slowly but surely it's changing. Not as quickly as we would like it to change. But I think when you have a woman director, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a more nuanced and dimensional portrayal. I would use as a negative example, perhaps Palms, of, you know, that we talked about it last week. It's not particularly the characters are very one-dimensional. But on the other hand, you know, when you do have a woman director, you oftentimes find women in lead roles, as your film was. It was really about a woman, a girl who grows up into being a woman and her dog. And I think it's just automatic if you are a woman director, you're going to want to see well-developed characters. And so I think, you know, I when you're talking about the NBC program, I noticed that, you know, Jen Salke, being the head of NBC Universal, they have a lot of different programs. I was actually a juror on a diversity film festival, short film festival, and they draw those people, a lot of these short filmmakers, and they find, you know, they help them launch careers. So I do think, you know, having women in high places and in being able to green light makes a huge difference. And then not just having women as directors, but also producers, editors, writers, crew people, you know, that's still, we're way behind in that. I think last year only 8% of directors were women. And producers, higher, 26%. Cinematographers, 4%. I mean, there's a huge
4% cinematographers are women.
Yeah,
that's the hardest area. I mean, when you're trying to, we have Rachel Morrison.
Yes, obviously, Rachel Morrison's wonderful,
fantastic.
But the fact that, you know, we can only name one or two people.
Does it seem at all that the women don't think of that as a field to go into, and more women need to be recruited into the pipeline, or what's going on with that?
I don't know. All of the above, mm-hmm. Because, I mean, because, you know, when even in television, you know, I'm looking for people in all different areas of the crew, and that seems to be the area, the camera department, that has
resistant to the change.
Not resistant. I don't know if that's the word, but maybe the support system isn't in place yet. Have that.
All right. I want to thank you both for being being with us. Appreciate it. Gail Mancuso is the director of the new film, A Dog's Journey, her feature directorial debut. But she's a veteran hand when it comes to directing actors with episodic television, the first woman to ever win an Emmy for a network television comedy. She's worked on all the great series of recent years. Gail Mancuso and our Claudia Puig, Film Week critic, president of the LA Film Critics Association, former roommate of Gail as well. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope to see you for our next Film Week screening, Saturday, July 27th, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown, the beautiful historic former United Artists Theater, Boogie Nights, Paul Thomas Anderson's film, 7 o'clock on that Saturday night. Tickets, kpcc.org/inperson.